Okay, now it's pushed to the on position.
Yes.
Good, all right. You took the place of one of my great grandsons now.
Oh, okay.
They know more than I do. Vic, how are you? Wow. Yisrael. Did you contact the person in charge who are you, Torah?
I did.
And call Rabbi Reuben. He'll be happy to hear from you.
I called Rabbi Shimon.
Good, good. And Rabbi Reuben, give chizuk because he came to shear 20 years. It's not a simple matter. The Ginsbergs, you should know. You're looking at a Jew sitting there. His father, famous professor, the Rebbe brought him to full Yiddishkeit. And he corresponded with me years ago, should he come in Aliyah? And I wrote back to him that I'm the last person in the world to ask, because he's a Lubavitcher. I'm a religious Zionist, every fiber of my body. I'm still a B'nai Kivanik. And to me, how to understand that Jews who believe in Torah are not living in Israel after the Holocaust is beyond my comprehension. So he said to me, wrote back to me, saved the letter. He shows up in class last week. This is 4 or 5 years later. Rabbi, how are you? This, that. He came in Aliyat, Mark, move over. Wife and 6 children to Be'er Sheva. It's not Beit Shemesh, where all you speak is English. And take a look, living history. But more than that, I found the original letter I wrote to him. He wasn't happy with the email, wanted the original. I found it in my office. So Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. Ready to roll. Okay, today is Sunday, Baruch Hashem, the 27th of January, 2019. And I greet the many students sitting in front of me and all those listening across the wide expanse of Jewish civilization. We're dealing here with a question. Today's going to be a very fascinating shiur, as you will see, because it has many side references. But we're dealing here with a problem. Here is Lieutenant Colonel, right? I have you ranked correctly, Rabbi, Doctor. Do you have a doctorate? I'm throwing it in a doctorate too. My students achieve a great deal. The Rebbe is a nice faff, but the students are unbelievable. Mark Mina. So here's a man. Was in the are you allowed to volunteer for the army? Allowed to volunteer? Talking the American army. The Israeli army is a different story. It has none of these limitations because the Israeli army is Mohammed Mitzvah, so these questions don't apply. But and the question was asked of Reb Menashe Klein. Now, Reb Menashe Klein, we spent 3 weeks on it or 4 weeks. We went through the sources, I'm sure you listened, and he reaches a very negative conclusion, and you can see he's turned off by what he saw in Buchenwald. And here I have to bring up the correspondence I got this week. And I hit the nail on the head last week. And this answers your wife's question. Why is he so negative? Well, look, here you are, redeemed. You're alive by miracles. The American army has come in. The war is not yet over. It's, I believe it's early 45. And here is, and I hit the nail on the head with my guess, because he doesn't mention the name, and here is the chaplain of the American army who redeemed Buchenwald, and there he is, Friday night, Rabbi Heschel Shachter, not to be confused with the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Heschel Shachter Sr., Zecher Tzadik Levracha, father of Rabbi J.J. Shachter, rabbi of Mashalu Jewish Center, and here he is leading the services Friday night. Hundreds of Jews, survivors, a handful of people, Jews from the army. And after davening Friday night, the Jeep pulls up and drives them back to where they're sleeping that night. Okay? And you saw what Menashe Klein wrote with such bitterness that this is orthodoxy. And, you know, he translates the word unorthodox. American chaplain, he knows English. Reb Menashe Klein, very fascinating personality. His English is, as far as I can see, perfect. And I also saw how good his English is. If you go on YouTube, he's talking to a group of Balei Tshuva in the shul he built with Eli Wiesel's money. Eli Wiesel's money, when he won the Nobel Prize, half the money went to build the shul in Ramat, in memory of Ilan Ritzel's parents, because they were chavrutas during the war and after the war. These two people, Ilan Ritzel said, when I have to talk to a rabbi, I go to Rav Menashe Klein. He had the greatest respect and understanding of Rav Menashe Klein. So there's I saw on YouTube, right before he died, about 5-6 years ago, here in Ramat, he's meeting with a group of Israeli Balei Tshuva. And it is a beautiful sight to see these young Israelis looking at Rav Menashe Klein with such awe. And he's speaking to them in Hebrew, but words he needs, he doesn't know the Hebrew word, he says it in English. His English was perfect. His gabbai translates from the English into the Hebrew for the people listening. So you see, that left a very terrible impression on him. And why do you want to get involved with the army? Why do you want to be a chaplain? And once you start driving Friday night, chutralo, it's like everything else in life, like the conservative movement. Once they were matir driving to shul Shabbos, Shabbos basically disappeared, and they themselves admitted, if you read what some of the key people, I spoke about this, I quoted them years ago when I gave lectures on the conservative movement in the Monday class. Now, so if you go back to last week's shiur, yours truly said, I have a feeling that it had to be a non-Jewish driver who drove for him. It can't be, I know Rav Heschel Schachter, my wife knows him from day one. She grew up in Marshall Parkway in that area. It cannot be that he drove on Shabbos or had a Jew drive him in a Jeep on Shabbos to take him back to sleep. My dear student Nachum Lamb writes to me, this issue was discussed in writing. How many of you remember there was a Art Scroll book, one of the early Art Scroll biographies, Lieutenant Birnbaum it was called. I knew him. Mayor Birnbaum was a frum Jew who was a lieutenant in World War II, who later lived in Bayit Vagan, davened every morning at the Kotel Vatikin, and he wrote a memoir. And sure enough, he addresses this very question. He describes how shortly after the Battle of the Bulge, he, this is Birnbaum, as the highest ranking Jew in his unit, was ordered to gather all the Jewish soldiers and take them to services. When he got there, he saw a young, clean-shaven chaplain in a reform-style tallit scarf leading abbreviated services in English. Now, you know what that means by the tallit scarf. When we were growing up, all they had was silk talesim. It was like a scarf, ein hachinami. Why? It was, in other words, less Jewish than a big talis that we all wear today. A little talis, that way you came into shul, you didn't have to feel they were overwhelming you. And even in the young Israels, I recall as a kid, even in the young Israels, those were the talesim available. Taliyot in Hebrew, talesim in Yiddish. It's basically, it should be taliyot in Yiddish, but for some reason, everyone says talesim. You follow? It's interesting. And then later in life, I remember when I left America 50 years ago, so then if you came into a proper Orthodox shul, there was a choice. You had both the little taliyot and the big proper ones. Today already, if you come in, let's say, to a young Israel, I don't believe you're going to see a little silk talis there, but I may be wrong. But that's what he's describing. And you can imagine, this is Rabbi Schachter with this little, what he calls a scarf, he assumed, and an abbreviated service, Birnbaum assumed that he was a Reform rabbi and just stood off to the side. The chaplain saw this and assumed, why is he standing on the side? He must be a dyed-in-the-wool atheist. So that after the services, he came over and tried to convince him to join in. They talked past each other for a while before the chaplain had a flash and said, pardon me for asking, but are you Orthodox? Yes, I am. Well, Shalom Aleichem, I'm Heschel Schachter from the Bronx. Birnbaum then realized that Rav Schachter knew that almost all of the Jewish soldiers had no background at all and would be turned off by a full, unabridged Orthodox service in Hebrew. So he was catering to the lowest denominator. They spent most of the rest of the war together maintaining a regular Seder in Gemara. Now, I got a second email from my Talmud Nachum Lamb, the same name as Norman Lamb, third president of Yeshiva University. They met, probably are distantly related. They're both Hungarians, come from the same area, and the family names are many times very similar. So they must be distant cousins. Nachum Lamb, the president, when Nachum Lamb, the student, was in Yeshiva College, and it must be about 20 years ago, so Normie Lamb, President Lamb, told his secretary, whenever my cousin with my name comes, he doesn't need an appointment. You let in Nachum Lamb to see Nachum Lamb immediately. By the way, Rabbi Norman Lamb was a very, very, he's not well today, but you should know, when, even if I say was, it means present. If you know about writing, one of the things I learned when I write, you're allowed to write was, and it means is and was, present and past. Very, very special person. A very humble person. A good person, a person of vision, and he had a miracle that he had the Sheldon Sokol to handle the money factors from. We all maledicted to my classmate Sheldon Zichron Levracha that he's a cheapskate. Because he's a cheapskate, YU under Rabbi Lamb, once they got started, did not have the financial problems which suddenly Richard Joel picked up and Ari Berman inherited, etc., etc. Now, in the next letter, which Nachum sent to me. Let me get my correspondent right here. 1 second. Ah. So here he tells the story that what happened was that Lieutenant Birnbaum had a driver who was not Jewish, and he lent his driver to Rabbi Schechter. For some more details about Mayor Birnbaum's sergeant, who became Rabbi Schechter's driver as well, his name was Rojo, Spanish for red, and he was an American Indian for California. Apparently his tribe didn't use last names. His civilian life after the war, he was a professional drummer and had a wife and children back in the States even during the war. He and Lieutenant Birnbaum stayed in touch for many years after the war. Birnbaum made most of his own food, even cooking in his helmet, and his sergeant was responsible for making sure none kosher made its way to him, and he learned a bit about kashrut. When they met a Rebbe, a survivor in a DP camp, the Kloisenberger Rebbe, Rojo protested when the Rebbe handed Birnbaum a plate of chalent, and Birnbaum had to ensure Rojo that he could trust the Rebbe's kashrut. So, all right, this tells you we were not far off, that he was not the one driving him. All right, I also want to mention something else that goes back to something I said in my lectures, and I have to stand on what I said. Generally, I'm the first one in the world to be happy to admit I didn't know it, and someone gave me more information. And what I research, I know thoroughly, but when I'm speaking general knowledge, I didn't research it to the end. And the last time I backed down, if you recall, I got into trouble, but that's a different story because I happened to be right. That was with the rabbi from Boston. Did he grow up in Boston or did he know the Rav later in life? I was right the first time. I accepted the correction too easily. Here, I'm not accepting the correction. I'll tell you what it's about. It's something I've mentioned and went into great detail about 20 years ago in class, 30 years ago already, when I dealt with the international dateline. So I made the point that lives were lost because of frumkeit. And what are you, if you know what I'm referring to, the Chazon Ish is Psak, when is Yom Kippur? And they were crossing the dateline, or weren't they crossing the dateline? The whole question of Kobe, Japan. So in order not to get involved with Machloika Taposkim and the Chazon Ish Shita, so a few of the Mira crowd who had the visas from Semple Sugihara, you got to tell the children who Semple Sugihara was, like a Tzadik Levracha, decided they wouldn't go until after Sukkot. They didn't want to fast 2 days Yom Kippur. And after Sukkot already, the Nazis had conquered, they couldn't get out, all was lost, and they perished. So here I get a letter from students who went to Mirim, and they're doing research, and they're checking it out. They evidently want to write the history, and I want to encourage them. And they give me their names, they've checked with Yad Vashem, and the correspondence with the Chazon Ish is later. This story cannot be true, that even though we've read it in books and you've said it, so I want you to know I wrote back to them that I accept no correction, because these ears heard the story from Rav Henoch Fishman. I would say 1949, 1950, Rav Henoch, with tears in his eyes, he was my Rebbe in 8th grade in Yeshiva Salanta. He was my second Shanghai contact. My first Rebbe in 7th grade was Reb Gershon Yankelevich, a name that all of you should recognize. And my second Rebbe at 8th grade was Reb Henoch Fishman. And Reb Henoch, I became very close. He lived in the neighborhood here, close to his son, Heshi, Zechut Tzadik Levracha. And Reb Henoch told me this, so that's living testimony. So I do not accept any correction. And all the research in the world cannot change what he told me. What I did write back to these people, and Rabbi Gil's student was involved too, he evidently made the connection, had to get in touch with me. What I did write back was, the fact that you found letters with the Chazon Ish with a later date doesn't mean they didn't know the Chazon Ish is psak earlier. You follow everyone with the Chazon Ish is psak. And the letters and the back and forth correspondence, sure, that could have been later. But the psak was out there right when the question of going to Japan and the international dateline arose. Finally, one more comment, a sad comment, and I don't want to give Musa, but all the time this disturbs you. In Israel, it's a little bit better. The talking in shul. So a Talmud wrote to me, he just was in shul, there was a simcha, a bar mitzvah, a young man. So people came in to wish the bar mitzvah boy mazel tov. So they come in, they davened elsewhere, which I understand. There are many shuls wherever this happened. It probably was in Irvain Israel, Cleveland. And many, many shuls. And one of the kids, Mechanchim, comes in during Ein Kelokeinu, and to give the kid mazel tov, and when he walks in, he stops and has a whole discussion with people in the middle of davening right towards the end. So someone goes over and says to him, "What are you, quiet, we're davening yet." He says, "Well, I waited until after Kaddish to start the discussion." The second mechanech comes in during Anas Miris, walks up to the front row, and with his back to the Aron Kodesh, carries on a conversation with one of the Mitpalalim. So I just want to tell you one story again that I need no proof for, b'didi haviyu, of these ears and these eyes. I'm davening in Young Israel of Woodmere. And in Israel of Woodmere, thousands of people, hundreds of people, five different minyanim. The main minyan at that time, it's before the breakaway, my student, the Yesh Kodesh Rebbe, straightened out the Young Israel, because in order to hold on to members, they had to act against the talking. But I can tell you, during Musaf, and I was introduced, I saw a new level of Yiddishkeit, people who studied with me, etc. And that davening means Shabbos. They come in time for the end of the laning and Musaf. I don't know where they daven Shachrit, etc., etc. Some of them disappear for the Kiddush Club, but then they come in half, 1 foot one way, 1 foot the other way. And the talking during the Chazaretz Hashas in Musaf, in Young Israel, it was worse than Yankee Stadium when Joe DiMaggio hit a Grand Slam home run in the 9th inning to win the game. Plain and simple. So this, I don't want to mention name, the family, a very, very fine family. People I'm very close with for many decades, wonderful, wonderful people. But one of the investments, money, then, these are not Jews like me. And Shabbos morning, it's right before Kriyat HaTorah, and my absolute word of honor, a guy comes over to the guy I'm sitting right next to, and Kriyat HaTorah, and tells him about a whole deal, $25,000 a piece, to go in with the stock market, something available, or buying a hotel. I mean, I forget, but it was he wanted 25 grand from him. And my friend says to him, I'll give you an answer after the Haftorah. And I want to tell you, he did give him an answer, and he went in. That Sunday, he gave him 25 grand. He became a partner. Yeah, I know what it was. Let me not go further. He shouldn't identify him. Now, just think for a minute what his Kriyas HaTorah was like. What was he thinking? Imagine Pashat Yisro, Esha Dibro, what we lay in yesterday, Lo Talu Amal Lo Tal Misbechi, the end of the Pasha, you can dashen for hours. I still remember my Rebbeim, the first instance of what Halach is about after Matan Torah, Lo Talu, not to have steps, but to have a ramp, modesty. Just think for a minute what this message is. Eila mishpatim ashet asim lefneichem, nisht frumkeit, not klat kosher, but to be a mensch, to be decent in your human relations. And you can imagine the whole Kriyat Torah, what was on his mind? Do I go with the 25,000 or don't I go? Daf Torah, and Baruch Hashem, he decided to go. So halacha l'maisa, we shouldn't talk during davening. Okay, now let's come back here. We finished out Rav Menashe Klein. I want to shift gears, as I said last week, and I want to deal with the Dovid Tzvi Hafman. And here I have to tell you, as I mentioned last week, and now I'll explain myself, the article in the Wikipedia on Rav Dovid Tzvi Hafman is fabulous. It's better than the Judaica. With the Wikipedia, to the best of my knowledge, they don't tell you who authored the articles. Am I correct? Anyone can correct me? I never see a name. I don't see a name here. There's an entry on me. I don't think there's a name either. Who authored the article? It took me a long time till I found out which Talmud of mine put that article in. And because I had to make corrections, and I wanted to know how to go about it. Persons from Chicago, Wishnitzer. You know who I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Ira Wishnitzer, fabulous guy. Okay. Now, the article is excellent. And here I want to show you something and say something and quote something that goes way beyond this particular shiur. This is basic to understanding Torah in the world of 2020. Rav Dovid Tzvi Hafman, I'll give you his years. I think I gave it last week, 1843-1921. Was a genius. Born in Hungary, educated in Hungary at Hungarian Yeshiva, which right away tells you what we would call in popular language a right-wing influence. Hungary, it's Hungary. Hadash Asum in HaTorah, Hatam Sofer, but with variations, but he was educated in Hungary. Then he goes to Germany. And he's exposed to the entire new development, as I explained last week, of Chachmat Yisrael, scientific Jewish scholarship, Wissenschaft des Judentum, Madacha Yahadut, call it what you wish. And this was a new concept that began as a result of the Enlightenment. I can't go into the whole history now. I did speak about it many decades ago. But there's no question that there was a big split in German Orthodoxy. We spoke about it last week. Rav Sinsdorfel Hirsch considered Chochmat Yisrael, if not total apikursus, certainly partial. And Rav Dr. Meyer Hildesheimer, the founder of the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, which was popularly called until Hitler destroyed it, Kristallnacht, Hildesheimer's, his approach was scientific Jewish scholarship. And what scientific Jewish scholarship means is you take Torah, and it can be Talmud Torah, it can be with a feeling of religion and dedication and belief and surrender to God, Nasa Benishma, but you view it not just from the halachic point of view. You view it what would interest a general scholar, historic background, economic background, interrelations with the non-Jewish world at the time, and you go on and on. For instance, in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, in the Midrash, you find many Greek words, you find Roman words. What do these words mean? Well, to a person who's a Talmud Chacham learning, you saw, I told you that word, Africa, whatever the word was I quoted in class, I said, all my Rebbein would translate this as Africa. And you saw a number of people wrote in that this is the country and it's in Turkey and exactly where, and they do the research. And there was a Professor Shmuel Krauss in Vienna who was 100 years ago the world ranking expert on Greek and Latin. You take Professor Shaul Lieberman, the great Rabbi Lieberman, the great Professor Lieberman, his knowledge in Greek and Latin was second to none. And that's what made him able to have such clear commentary on the Yerushalmi and on the Tosefta, because whenever there was a Greek and Latin word, he could translate it. Now, this is very fine with Torah Shebaal Peh. Now take it a drop further. Now you come to the Bernard Rebbel Graduate School quandary. What about Torah Shebichtav? Can you use scientific Jewish scholarship? What do you do if you research and you find 1,000 years ago every Torah that you come up with has variant readings that we don't have today? I'm not talking about what we spoke about in class, chaser v'yeter, with a vav, without a vav, with a yud, without a vav. We're talking a variant word. No, a from Jew. Are you allowed to research? Are you allowed to check? Are you allowed to be engaged in this? This is a very, very delicate question. Where do you draw the line? Where does belief conquer scientific approach? Where is scientific approach allowed? Can a religious Jew ever be a scientific scholar? Or by definition, how can you be objective if you're going to be involved with questions that reflect on your faith? Torah, the text, what do we have? And this very, very serious question. And here, I can only tell you, a lot has been written on this, and the best approach, and this was someone I knew quite well, you've all heard the name Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, not to be confused with his first cousin, Dr. Mordechai Breuer. I knew both of them. Two Yekes, two great-grandchildren, Rav Simcha Ophiel Hirsch, two fascinating individuals. One, Dr. Mordechai Breuer, became, by the way, he had smicha too, but I'm stressing the doctor. He became a professor of Jewish history at Bar Ilan University. His doctorate was based upon the Yuknasha Leida. He describes German orthodoxy before World War I. Most fascinating. The same problems we have in America now, they had then in Germany. Fascinating. The other Mordechai Breuer, who had an honorary doctorate from Hebrew U, he became the biggest expert on the Bible, on the biblical text, and he did research, and he reached a very simple conclusion that a person can research from today to tomorrow. You can have all the theories in the world, but the text that we read in the Torah has to be the one our parents gave us, our Rebbeim gave us. The research does not affect halacha lemaisa. And I can tell you, I told this to you when we dealt with this in a different context, I don't know if it was this year, last year, but recently, in the last year or two, this was why you shaking. I told you the story of a name, Reb Meir Simcha Feldblum. Anyone remember the name from YU? I'm on in years. Dov, it's ancient history. The Rebbe's living it and you're looking at me. Wow, when, where? Reb Meir Simcha Feldblum was a survivor. He was a telisha, and a genius. I know people who survived with him in the forests, and they said, this is what they told me, he was so bright, people used to say, we should follow Meir Simcha. He will help us survive. He knows what he's doing. So Rav Meir Simcha survived. He came to yeshiva. And the Rav loved him. He was a Talmud. You know, the Rav used to get angry. The American kids, what the heck did we know? You know, today I'm not ashamed what I know. But the kid of 20 to 18, what did you know? You learned 100 Daf Gemara in your life? Rav Meir Simcha came already a full-blown Talmud Chacham. So the Rav loved him. And when I came into the yeshiva, he was one of the first Rebbeim. I later took his place, actually. That's what it amounts to. He was one of the first Rebbeim of the opening classes in the yeshiva. Rav Meir Simcha, everyone loved him, a wonderful man. He married Rav Ephraim Yalas' daughter from Philadelphia. Later there's a tragedy. Again, it's living history. Early 70s, she was crossing the street outside the yeshiva on a Sunday morning, and two drunken drivers, Puerto Ricans, were racing their cars, and they killed her in front of the yeshiva. It was a tremendous tragedy. He later came in Aliyah to forget his tzarat and married the Talmud Mufheket, Talmidah Mufheket of Nechama Leibowitz, a Sfadik lady, a Taimaniya, a genius in Bible, but too brilliant for her edah. She hadn't married. And they married L'Aricha Jemim Tovim. I don't know if she's alive. He's gone already quite a few years. He taught at Bar Ilan. I believe she also taught. Anyway, so Rav Meir Simcha, while he's at yeshiva, he's going to Bernard Revel Graduate School. It was very attractive for us because it was right across the street. So you could do both. And by the time I was a senior in yeshiva college, I was taking courses in Bernard Revel Graduate School. But I went into halacha, I went into shenach and shibbut. What I went into never presented a problem. He went into Chochmat Yisrael, the whole approach to Talmud with scientific Jewish scholarship. And the Rav was quite upset. The Rav said, I remember hearing it with my own ears, Chabneda, as Professor Weiss had gechapt my Meir Simcha from me. I'm afraid that Professor Avram Weiss, who was the ranking scholar in scientific Talmudic study, world famous name, all his descendants live in Israel without any exception. Professor saved from Hitler. He was on the Judenrat in Warsaw. He was on the Judenrat, saved with miracles. His wife, who was a student and much younger and had energy, somehow she got them to Spain, from Spain to Portugal, and from there they sailed to the United States and grew up in the Bronx, where their children were friends with Arnie Rothkopf and Malka Grund, Marlene Grund, my wife. We were friends at children, same age. So he got very big in Talmudic scientific scholarship. And he became a professor before Bar Ilan at Bernard Revel Graduate School. He, Reb Meir Simcha, became the Talmud Mufak of Reb Avraham Weiss. In other words, that's what I'm talking about. He got very big. He was attracted. He had Rav Soloveitchik as a Rebbe, Maria Rebbe, and he had Professor Weiss, and he went the way of Professor Weiss. So then he published an article in Chorev that was a YU publication, doesn't exist today. Had some very interesting articles, including Chorev Talpiyot, very interesting. YU was putting out those publications many years ago. And he did a piece on Eide Chatima Kate ve Eide Mesira Kate. It's the tremendous machloket in relation to get. What creates a get? A get, in order to divorce a woman, it's not a ktuvah. I've told you this many times over the decades. A ktuvah you can pick out of the garbage. Remember I told you the story where I picked the ktuvah with Rabban Soloveitchik, where there was a terrible mistake and no one had a ktuvah. We found in the drawer, mamish the drawer, of the owner of the catering in the hotel, the Broadway Central. He had some ripped up ktuvah that some rabbi threw away, but it wasn't filled in. We used it as a ktuvah. You know, that's it, a ktuvah. I don't want to frighten you, but a ktuvah is a guarantee that the man that the lady is marrying is upright and decent and will provide for her. That's what a ktuvah is. Has Herzl lived up to the ktuvah? What do you say? Yes or no? Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. Okay. That's a ktuvah, up right there. A get, what a get does, a metaphysical miracle. It takes a couple that were one and divides them asunder. So you need kavana. The get has to be written. None of you have seen the get, how it's written. Lishmo, lishmo, lishen, gerushin. And the sofer who writes, the man has to authorize, and the edim have to sign. Now, do the edim create the get? Or no, the edim are not the important factor. They signed the get, so we have a record of who signed, then we can always trace back who witnessed it. But the edim, when the get is given, that is the most important factor. You follow? Is it Eidei Mesira or Eidei Netina? What's the word there? Eidei Mesira, Eidei Chatima, excuse me. Right, exactly. What creates the get? Okay, so there's a whole machloket. Basically, even in Pesach, there's a difference, but the majority seem to feel it's Eidei Mesira that create the get. So I remember Meir Simcha wrote a whole article, and Rabbi Parnas was very upset with the article. Now, they were contemporaries. They were the same age, basically. And they got smicha, basically, at the same time. And Rabbi Yehuda Parnas, a very famous name, later goes from YU to Lander College. So he was very upset with the article. Why? Because in the article, Rabbi Meir Simcha took a sheet of the chuya that most Rishonim didn't agree with, and he based this article and tried to prove from other sources that this was the correct approach. So Rabbi Meir Simcha was challenged. I heard this with my own ears. I remember the whole conversation. Rabbi Meir Simcha was challenged. How do you go against everyone else? The overwhelming majority of Rishonim don't hold this way. And Rabbi Meir Simcha answered, research is one thing, and halacha l'maisa is another. Halacha l'maisa, I follow what my Rebbeim taught me, what the Shulchan Aruch paskins. But in research, I'm allowed freedom of expression. We'll put it that way. Eidei Mesira, Eidei Chatima, I'm free to choose, I'm free to prove. Halacha l'maisa, I do what I was taught. It is parallel to what later in Israel I read by Rav Mordechai Breuer, by his students, by the whole question of biblical research. Now, this question was raised very sharply by Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. And here in the article on Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, they call him a selective Wissenschaft practitioner. Now, what does that mean? And I was very impressed because what they quote here is exactly what I quoted in class 20, 30 years ago. That's why I wonder who wrote it, because he got right to the kernel that I quoted in this very classroom. And he's quoting, this is in, among other things, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman was very prolific. He wrote on Chumash. He wrote on Medrash. He answered Sheilot Halacha L'maisa. He later becomes, once he starts teaching in Germany, he first began as a high school teacher for Rav Hirsch, the Beit Sefer Reali in Frankfurt. And then he became the Rebbe, the dean, the rector, popular language, the Rosh Yeshiva of Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary until his death in 1921. And he was the dominant halachic figure. So he wrote in many, many areas. But in his introduction to Vayikra, I'm now quoting Reb David Tzvi Hoffman, I willingly agree that in consequences of the foundation of my belief, I am unable to arrive at the conclusion that the Pentateuch, meaning the Chumash, was written by anyone other than Moses. We believe that the whole Bible is true, holy, and of the divine origin, that every word of the Torah was inscribed by divine command, is expressed in the principle Torah min hashamayim. We must not presume to set ourselves up as critics of the author of a biblical text or doubt the truth of his statements or question the correctness of his teaching. The Jewish commentator must therefore constantly be on guard against interpreting the passage in such a way as to appear to be in conflict with traditional halacha. Just as the Torah is a divine revelation, must not contradict itself, in the same way it must not contradict the oral law, which is of divine origin. And in other words, what he's saying here is the quandary. If you know anything about Bernard Revel Graduate School, they have very limited studies in biblical criticism, because anything dealing with biblical criticism will immediately bring you to the border of what's within and what's without. It's a very delicate area. Bar-Ilan has been criticized over the decades for having too much freedom in this particular field. But here you have Rav David Zvi Hoffman state something which becomes bedrock to anyone dealing with Tanakh in this fashion. You cannot allow it to misconstruct or reprimand or negate Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. Then, of course, the question is, how can you be a scientific Jewish scholar if you have limitations? Yes, as Torah Jews, we have to have these limitations. Quote him again in one of his works on the Mishnah. Thus, in the study of the Holy Scriptures, on the one hand, we consider the authenticity and integrity to be absolute, and we can recognize as true only such results as do not question that premise. With the Mishnah, on the other hand, any criticism, as well as any research as to the age of the Mishnah and the times of its expression in the extant form, is not only considered permissible to us, but even required for the scientific study of the tradition. You follow what he's saying? Okay, I can show it to you on the Israeli scene. This question came up for the last 10 years, widely discussed on the Israeli scene. Herzl, you learn Gemara. Tell me, on one daf in the Gemara, how many generations are you touching upon? Just think for a minute. On one daf in the Gemara, you can have Tanayim, you can have Amarayim, first generation, second generation, third generation, all the way down to Ravina and Ravashi. Now, where does it all come from? How do they all come together? If anyone is going to publish what's being said in this year, the Rebbe, the names of the students, the interaction, we're all here. It's happening. You open the Gemara, on one daf of the Gemara, inevitably on every page, you have 200 years of different concepts. Right from the Mishnah, right down to Chatimat HaTalmud. You may even have something that the Savrayim put in. You follow? How does it come? No, when you learn Gemara, when you open a Gemara, that doesn't trouble you. That doesn't bother you. Mark, when you learned in Gris, who paid attention to different levels? Talmud Torah, the traditional way of learning, learn at Daf Gemara. You walked into the Rav Shir, you studied with the Rav. Did he ever get involved in different levels? You understand? The scientific approach, you take Professor Avraham Weiss, who I knew not just as a Rebbe, as a professor, I knew him as the father of my good friends from B'nai Akiva. He once said to me, all my books, no one can understand them. Who am I publishing for? Myself, My brother-in-law, Professor Hanuch Albeck, he was already in Israel, great in Talmud. Maybe Reb Shaul Lieberman, Professor Orbach. How many people can understand? You know what his books were about? He took the entire Talmud and basically reconstructed it chronologically. Follow? What a difference in approach. Here in Israel, how did this come up? Knew anyone following what went on here in Chinuch? The whole question that haunts us, how do we get kids excited about Gemara? It's a question, and not only in Israel, it's in America, in England, in South Africa, in Australia. Kids today, you're taking kids, you open a Gemara, it's a different language, a different culture, a different milieu, concepts that are not part of their daily life. You open the Gemara, it's not a baseball game, right or wrong. I mean, it's not a cricket match, it's a different world. It's not a soccer game. I saw a kid, we were davening marble in my building, we have a Motzoi Yontif, Motzoi Shabbos for about 30 years. We have a minion in the building, either inside or out in the parking lot, depending on the weather. We get a very big crowd. People come from all over. The shuls are filled. There's a minion a block away. But it's Israel, Baruch Hashem, the Nei Buddhist, filled with Jews who daven. So while we're davening, I see this kid, must be about 5, 6 years old, with a big kippah and peyot, a big kippah shmugah, must be a Merkaz Harav father. And the kid is playing with a ball, soccer. I tell you, I had to concentrate on that. I had to fight to concentrate on that. And this kid was good. He's kicking the ball around. I see my great-grandson, my eldest great-grandchild. So he already, we were at an upsharing of a younger brother, Kevin Shmuel. So I see the kid is holding an iPad. I said, Ma Thomas Takel, what are you looking at? Shows me a soccer game. And he's a good guy. So I asked him, I told you the story a few years, I asked him, Bishat Ma'asa, tell me, what's more important, learning Chumash or watching a soccer game? And boy, he bought me with the answer, Hukanauti, but you've written to better. He said, in school, learning Chumash is much more important. But outside of school, I'm allowed to watch a soccer game. A few months later, in my house, I called him over and I said, Yishai, tistakel, at my iPad. And I showed him a baseball game. And he knew how to hit the ball. I couldn't believe it. How do you know this? He knew how to pitch. He showed me the pitching, the hit. But he's a soccer player, a player and a fan. Now you take a kid, you're going to teach him Gemara. You want to get him excited. You want to get him involved. So some people here, one of them of American origins, I always say the rebels in Israel, everyone fighting the kashrut, fighting the rabbinate, fighting the Israel. Whoever you see, they're fighting the establishment. Look for the American. Look for the Anglo. Look for the poor resh. Ani Amerikoyu. You'll find it very quickly. So they wanted to introduce Gemara Rivadim. You've heard that expression? Layers, and that the Gemara should be colored. I mean, these ideas they came up with, a kid should see the Tana is in red print. The first generation of the Amoraim is in blueprint. The third generation, and you get the, and some people, Tucker, introduced it. The kids were more confused. You have no idea. So I come back to the Rakefet point of view. The Rakefet point of view is very simple. Halacha l'maisa, Talmud Torah has to be the traditional fashion. When I was in fifth grade, I had a Rebbe introduce this, Eile Mitziyat Shleila Chayav L'Chachriz. He knew this Rebbe, Lo Aleinu, at Reed Washington, and I got compliments from Chicago. It was the same story there. Anyone my age will tell you the Rebbeim in the day schools, the few day schools that existed, were not Shomer Shabbos. Maybe they were Shomer Kashrut, we can't even be sure. These were all people who came to America and wanted to succeed. They went into business, they went bankrupt, they tried to sell insurance, no one was dying anymore, quoting the Ibn Ezra, etc. These people, so what did they do in their youth? They learned, they taught This teacher, Taka, loved teaching, Mr. Perech. I remember him with warmth. But Gemara, American kids, we were bored stiff. Tashema, this one. So one day he said in class, and I never will forget this, you boys don't, you don't understand. I don't recall, I think he spoke Hebrew. I think that class was in Hebrew. We had classes in Yiddish, Hebrew, English. I think that class was in Hebrew. You fellas don't understand. This is a boxing match. Abaye versus Rava. Joel Wolcott versus Joe Lewis. Round one to Abaye. Round two to Rava. Wow, did we get interested. From that day until today, including today, I already had a Gemara open at 4:15 this morning. So including from then until today, you got to get a kid interested. You learn the traditional way. Later in life, if you're so inclined and you know Shas and Paiskim, all right, get involved with some scientific study, do a doctorate, fine. Beautiful doctorates were done on the Rabbi Usher Ziv, on the Ramah, his famous doctorate, his editing, the footnotes, the social, economic, all the topics that you don't necessarily get involved with in a regular Gemara Shia. But that's the dessert. It's the icing on the cake. Now, this was Reb David Zvi Hoffman. With this in mind, and all that he knew, and the man's knowledge, I remember he wrote on Shmuel. So I forget who it was, one of the members of the faculty of BMT or Gruss came over to me. Are you familiar with Reb David Zvi Hoffman? I said, of course. He said, what that man knows, he had just gone through a Hebrew translation from his German work on the Tanna, Shmuel. All right, the man was Bucky and Shas and Paiskim and Midrash and every language that they say he knew, 11 different ancient languages. These are rare minds that come along. If you knew Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, how many of you knew Reb Aaron Lichtenstein? Could you believe the man's knowledge? You know, Reb Aaron, say hey, that I'm not making it up. And Reb Aaron Lichtenstein was in awe of Reb Shaul Lieberman. He would speak about Reb Shaul Lieberman. These people, the knowledge is unbelievable. So this was the Melamed Lahoyel, but he was the Posek. With everything we spoke about, here is an individual deeply steeped in learning, deeply steeped in Yirat Shemayim, deeply steeped in the reality of where the Jews are in Germany 100, 120, 30, 40 years ago. He was the Posek. Now, he dealt with many, many questions. Many of these questions later, if Moshe Feinstein has to deal with. Many of these questions we're struggling with in Israel today, right this past weekend. Did you see all the freebies given out? For some reason, all the magazines had articles on Geirut, on conversion, on converts. The Torah is given, the Jews convert, they get into the Brit, non-Jews are welcome. This topic in modern times, until modern times, did you ever learn the Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya? The topic of Geirut, I think it's too little simanim. There's nothing whatsoever in the Rishonim. It's where Sugyan Yavamah, it's Sugyan with the two Sugyas and Shas, basically, where Geirut is touched upon, the Chorot and Yavamah. The very, very little material, the Rambam, Perek Gimel, Hilchit Nashim, why is there so little material? Why? Chichot Yisuri Bia, I should say, Perek Gimel. Why is there so little material? Because in two modern times, if someone converted to Judaism, they risked their life. You understand? You heard the news this morning in the Philippines, some Arab terrorists blew up two churches in the middle of their prayers. That what happened this morning in the Philippines, and happens all over, and yet we had a president of the United States, Obama, beyond comprehension. My name is Hussein. My name is Hussein. What he said in Egypt, beyond comprehension. But the Jews, if you converted, knew the famous Gezedek at the time of the Vilna Gaon, they burned them alive. Yantiv Sheni on Shavuos, God guts a lapit and what you. So there's very little material. If someone converted, there was no shaila, no nothing. They converted b'lev v'nefesh. You come into modern times. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry wants to be a Jew. Marilyn Monroe converted to Judaism. No, right or wrong. You can give a whole list of converts to Judaism. It's beyond words. Converted, what converted, when converted, they're Marilyn Monroe. God have mercy, what's happened to us? New state of Israel. You have on to 400,000 Russians who are not Jewish. Russian origins, yeah, from other countries, but it's from France, from America, but it's 10, 20, 30, 40, 100, 1,000. We're talking 400,000. What do you do? So you see these shilas, you see the Malamed Laholil, filled with questions like this. Rav Moshe Feinstein, filled with questions like this. Now in Israel, who's right? Who's in charge? The Batei Dinim, the chief rabbinate, Tzoha, Beit Hillel, you know what I'm talking about? These are all rabbinic organizations. When I came in Aliyah, there was one chief rabbinate. Today, Tzoha, Heksha, you're going to face it. You travel through Israel, you're going to see a Heksha Tzoha. Can you depend upon it? Can't you depend upon it? And these problems overwhelm us. And the Malamed Laholil, it's like an encore, it's like an overture to the 20th century, all that happens and continues. Now, the drawback of the Shelet and Shvat Malamed Laholil is that he never published it himself. And this is true about anyone and everyone. What the master publishes is fabulous. What happens after his death will never be on the same level. Give me a simple example. Moria Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, published very little during his lifetime. Abriska, have you read Rakefet's two volumes on the Rav where Rakefet explains why the Rav never published perfectionism? Quoting Reb Chaim, not everything you think do you say. Not everything you say do you write. Not everything that you write do you publish. Every time they were worried. All right, the Rav published on philosophy for his first major publication, 44, Ish Halacha, which to me is the Rav's magnum opus. So Rakefet says that when it came to philosophy, the Rav knew you can't be right, you can't be wrong. Philosophy, everyone has a different opinion, you understand Kant and Hegel and the Marburg school. So on philosophy, Mela. But he had to establish when he came to yeshiva that he knew something. You know, when he came, everyone's laughing. Reb Moshe's son, who is he? Clean shaven, from Boston. What does he know? He had to establish who he was. Baruch Hashem. So he published. Oh boy, did he publish! But in philosophy, the lonely man of faith. All my grandchildren went to high school in Israel. Every kid in the Chinuch Malachti Dati system studies the lonely man of faith. All right, I don't know in America that they know the lonely man of faith, item one, item two, because this is beautiful. It's not halacha. You can't be wrong. You can't. It's fabulous. Halacha, when the Rav found out, we were taking notes. So I forget already whose notebook it was. We took one of the notebooks and we rewrote it stencils before the exam. You don't even know what stencils are before mimeographing. It's an ancient world. You get your hands all dirty with the ink. You used to run the stencil and it would print out more ink, print out 50 copies. And the Rav walked into class and he found a copy. An atom bomb exploded. He recalled Asid Belevin Nefesh with every chumra in the world. We'd be in Cherem Nidui. You cannot stencil my Sheirim. He said, Rebbe, but we take notes. He says, look, you take notes, they'll find the notebook, they'll know it's a Narishkeit. But if it's a stenciled form, they'll think I approved it. And that was the end of the note-taking. Then in 56, let me record this, people will never know. Ear witness, eyewitness, don't have to cite any sources. Rakefet saw it with his own eyes. 56, they began recording the Rav. Four kids had to carry the tape recorder in to record him. One young man was trusted by the Rav. Of course, the Rav knew his father and his mother and knew the kid. The kid was from New Haven. His name, Aaron Bat, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Rabbi Bat. The Rav trusted Pat. He took the tape, the reel, and he would give it to the Rav. And boy, the Rav, don't let anyone copy it, don't let anyone see it, don't let anyone hear it. I will take the tape. And he took it back to Boston. You've read about this in the New York Times in the 70s, the lawsuit, who owns the tapes, etc., etc. But this was the Rav, a perfectionist. And what's being published now for manuscript, you take the book on ethics, some of the books, it doesn't have an ending. They got the notes. He was giving a course, Bernard Revel. They had to figure out the people working the book, editing it. They concluded the book. It's them. It's not the Rav. It's not the master. It's not the master's hand. The same thing with the Ramat Lahoyel. He kept the notebook in which he wrote the questions he got and what he answered. Later, after his death, posthumously, his children published the Malamed Lahoyel. Okay, now let me quote. And this is the famous Malamed Lahoyel, which in the Inyan of Geirut, you all know, I've said it 1,000 times, and that Reb Moshe has it in writing, that he had the case of a Kohen to a Giyoret. The case that we spoke about, David Hartman, Rabbi Reuben had heart failure, that Rakefitz quoted David Hartman in class 1,000 times over, didn't give him heart failure. But when he read it in writing, oh boy, he couldn't believe his eyes. So the Malamed Lahoyel dealt with the case of a young girl who converted as a child, and now she's going with a Jewish man who happens to be a Kohen. A Kohen can't marry a Giyoret. It's a terrible problem. The Rav had the problem. Read Rakefet. The Rav said, I had to tell them, there's, with all my understanding and my commiseration, there's nothing I can do. And they just walked away from each other. And the tragedy was she made the Jew from. The Kohen was not from. He met her in graduate school. The convert made him from. And then he goes to the cemetery and he sees his grandfather's tombstone with the split fingers. And he's a Kohen. And we fed. This is a, so the Malamed Lahoyel came up, let them marry, not have a promise to keep Tarat Mishpacha. He gave in to the pressure. I think she had converted under the age of 3. Anyway, the Rav discussed this issue in the early 70s when it became a course celebre here in Israel, Helen Zeidman. I still remember the name. She was a Gioret, marrying a Kohen, became a course celebre, Rabbi Gorin, etc. And everyone quoted the Malamed Lahoyel. So if you listen to the tapes of the Rav in the Yache Kala that year, one of the Rabbanim asks Rebbe, what about the Malamed Lahoyel? He quotes, and the Rav gets hysterical. It cannot be. He wouldn't say such a thing. Impossible. And totally, totally dismisses it. Reb Moshe, with the same question, someone told, Reb Ephraim Greenblatt of Memphis, writing to Reb Moshe, that the Malamed Lahoyel, Reb Moshe says, impossible, it cannot be, Yena Sefer Zet Tachet Yadi, this book is not under my hands, I haven't seen it, but impossible that he wrote this. And he doesn't even get it. He could have sent Reb David around the corner to 33 Canal Street, to Otsar Sfarim. From East Broadway to Canal Street, it would take 3 minutes to walk from Mesifta to Tiferet Yerushalayim to Otsar Sfarim to Yankel Goldman. Yankel, my father wants to borrow a copy of the Malamed Lahoyel. It was reprinted in New York. In a minute, Reb Moshe would have had it. Well, I'm not even interested in looking. Cannot be. All right, this is the Malamed Lahoyel. Now, what am I quoting from? Malamed Lahoyel, I'm quoting Siman Mem Bet. And here too, he writes an introduction before. That introduction itself is very fascinating. And he says, Chuvazot, this response them. This response, I'm writing that the world should see, shall pidina d'shaspa paiskim anu mechuyavim lishmar pi melech v'chukei hamedina be'eretz Ashkenaz. The world should see that according to our holy Torah, we are obligated to listen to the king, meaning the civil authorities, and the laws of the land in Germany. This introduction will be repeated again in a different context by no less a personage than Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. This introduction raises another question that has come up in modern times. No, let's put it into context. Many things I've been able to do in my life because people helped me. But one thing I did in my life, one achievement, I did against everyone laughing at me and saying it will never happen, you're wasting your time. And you know what that is. That's the documentary on the Rebbe's life, The Lonely Man of Faith. I did it all myself. Everyone laughed at me, mocked me, took me 3 tries. Third try, I got $1 million and got a producer. And the results, many of you have seen. If you haven't seen it, go get it and see it. It's Kedai. Now, the person who did it, Eisenberg, has not done anything great subsequently. But this was a young man. I had a degree in filmmaking, English, etc., writing, U of P, and had the advantage that he never met the Rav, studied with the Rav, so that he was totally as objective as any human being can be. And that was very important. Now, this came out, and if you know Rakepet, I'm a team player. He's the producer. I'm an advisor. I can't take total responsibility for what he said. There were certain things there that people wanted to hang me, criticized me, yelled at me. I said they had freedom of choice, and some people who knew the Rav very well say he's right, and that my understanding, your understanding, is wrong. One of the things that came out was he interviewed Rabbi Saul Berman. I trust you recognize the name, Rabbi Saul Berman, one of the forefounders, ancestors of Chovevei Torah, I'll put it that way, a long process. Happens to be my classmate, a very fine individual, but spent some formative years being in Stanford University. I think he was on Hillel there, chaplain, whatever, and those had a big impact on him. Okay. So if you see the documentary, you'll see he says, when you came to the Rav with the question, the Rav would say, what do you think the answer should be? And then the Rav would try to see whether he could justify your approach. So people said to me, that's the way you treat halacha? What do you think the answer should be? It said, look at the documentary, you'll see. So I said, look, in certain areas, this is correct. Those of you that are Talmidei Chachamim know very well that in the areas of Heter Aguna, or the area of Heter Mamzerut, we are bound halachically to do everything in our power to try to find a solution. Kol hamatir aguna achat, kilu bana achat mechuvot Yerushalayim. That's the Bach. The Bach says, if you're matir and aguna, if you can find reason to permit a woman to remarry who doesn't know the whereabouts of her first husband, it's like you built a section in Jerusalem. I always apply this concept to Ani Run, who built the Shtiblach in Katamon, which built Katamon and raised prices there. Today in Katamon, you can't talk about an apartment with 3 bedrooms under $1 million. You understand? And I'm not over-exaggerating. I'm stating facts. And that's all due to one man, Ani Run. So, all right. Kilu bana achat mechuvat Yerushalayim kol hakavod Rabbi Arnold Run, why you musmach, even though he's not proud of why you, because he would like them to lock up every rabbi, tie him up, and send him to Israel. How do you run a yeshiva in the year 2020, and you don't insist everyone go in Aliyah? So he gets very angry at me when I mention his yichus, that he's a why you musmach. All right. You take Mamzerut, why should a kid suffer? Because his parents sinned. So I said, maybe that's what the Rav was referring to. But you know something? What did you just hear me say? You just heard a great Talmud Chacham say, I'm writing this tshuva so the world should know we're obligated to listen to the laws of the land in Germany. And you're going to see this with the Rav even sharper, that their beginning, ab initio, melachatchila, we have to accommodate the German government, the American government. Very interesting introduction. Very interesting point of view. Is it correct? Not correct? Let the issue hang fire. As I said, when we get to Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, he's even clearer and sharper than the Melamed Lahoel. And what's the question? That now there is a law that any healthy male citizen has to go into the armed forces and has to serve either a year, 2 years, or 3 years in accordance to what he's doing in the army. And when he'll be in the armed forces, Hu anus shem lechalel shabbatot v'yomim tovim. He's going to be obligated to be a mechalel shabbat and yontif. Is he mechuyev to do everything in his power to avoid this service? After all, he is hayarei et davar Hashem v'shomer kol mitzvot haTorah. And he has to do everything in his power. Shelo yavo lidei chilul Shabbat olam. And this is the very question, exactly the question that Reb Menashe Klein gets so many years later, exactly the question that the Rav gets so many years later. And this is the Melamed Lahoil that Reb Menashe Klein refers to. Not for me. I don't agree with him. He says, my Talmud showed it to me. And this is the question. Now, I want to tell you in parentheses. We spoke about a great Jew, Rabbi Yosef HaTzadik Mender Lovitch. Did you hear that name? We had a kid sitting here from Torah Shraga a few weeks ago and he never heard the name, and I filed an official protest with the Yeshiva High School he went to in Chicago. But this kid is a smart kid. He did his homework, went online, and told me all about Rabbi Yosef. Have you heard the name of Yosef HaTzadik? If you didn't hear the name, your parents are at fault, and they owe you a great deal of information on Rabbi Yosef HaTzadik Mender Lovitch. Not talking ancient history. The Rebbe knows him. I know him. If I know him, you have to know him. No, Rabbi Yosef HaTzadik finally got out, and tell me, he went to Touro College in Israel. He did a master's. Remember what I told you he wrote his master's on? The Cantonists. Do you know what the Cantonist means? Oh boy, you fellas need a lot of background, you young people, I should say. The Cantonist. The Russian government took children 25 years in the Russian army. And the Jewish kids, 25 years, who remained Jewish? The pressure, even if it wasn't outward pressure, but the social economic pressure, convert. Got it? And he wrote on the Cantonists. Now, notice, with the Cantonists, there was no question that Jews should do everything in his power to avoid the army. And lo aleinu, we even have documentary history. People shot off a finger. People shot off a toe. People deformed their bodies so they should be exempt. But there you're talking about when in reality you served so many years, it was almost impossible to remain Jewish. Jewish. We're not talking about observant. Notice what the question says here. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. It's not the end of the world. This is a different army. This is a modern state. This is Germany before the Holocaust. This is Germany where there was still respect for religion, for the individual, even for the Jew. So that you have an entirely different concept here than Cantonism. Tell me, who wrote a sefer pleading with soldiers to remain from in the Russian army? Chafetz Chaim, Machne Yisrael. That was after the Cantonist period, but he, the Chafetz Chaim, wrote a sefer. It's worth studying that sefer, pleading with them that even if you have to sin, even if you have to eat non-kosher food, but minimize the Issa. Remember, you're a Jew. Don't eat the chaza. Don't eat the meat. Even if you have to eat the soup. Chafetz Chaim pleading with the Jews in the army. Remember, you're a Jew. Remember, the army will end. But see, there's a whole development till you come modern times. In every Western country, you have to have an army. Lo aleinu. The world is no different today than 100 years ago, 200 years ago. The world can blow up overnight. The only thing that keeps the world from blowing up is parity, is that we all have the atom bomb. If we didn't all have the atom bomb, God have mercy, what would be going on? Could you imagine if Russia didn't have the atom bomb, what America would be doing? If America didn't have the atom, what Russia would be doing? If Israel didn't have the atom bomb, what the Arabs would be doing? This helps us. It's a different world, but it's the same story. You must have an army. And this is an army a year, two, three. It's a serious question. Okay. Now, again, everyone quotes the Gemara Shabbat, Daf Yutet Amud Aleph. Everyone quotes the Baal Hamor. And it's the basic question, are you allowed to travel? Are you allowed to do anything in life when the chances are what you're doing will lead to Chilul Shabbos? And it's a very basic question. What is the Gemara about? Does the Gemara mean I can't do anything? Or no, until Wednesday, you don't have to worry about the next Shabbat. When the next Shabbat comes, then you worry, and then the halachic rules. Ones rachmana patre, if you have no choice. Pikuach nefesh. This is the basic question. And the Balmar of Zerachya HaLevi, who was one of the great Rishonim, his approach basically is followed through the halacha and the Shulchan Aruch, that Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, a Jew can do whatever he wants. He doesn't have to be concerned, where will I be next Shabbat? Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, then you have to be concerned. And even then, if it's a Devar Mitzvah, you can get on a boat on Friday. You can do whatever you have to do. Shabbat will come. You'll ask your rabbi, I'm on the boat, I'm on the plane, I'm in the army. What happens? I'm an ones, I have to do what I have to do. Pikuach nefesh, if I don't do it, lives will be lost. We'll be mater, we'll allow it. And this is the way we paskin. And he says that when we come to the German army, you're absolutely allowed to go in. We paskin like the Shulchan Aruch. You don't have to be concerned with what's going to happen next week, 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, a year from now. Today, no one's being Machalo Shabbos. It's Tuesday, could even be Wednesday, Thursday, because he develops the idea that going into the German army may be even a mitzvah. Why will it be a mitzvah? And here we get involved with, this is a Chatam Sofer, did you see traces of it in the Noda B'Yehuda, in modern Psak? You don't want to create anti-Semitism. You don't want the world, he's saying it here in the Tshuva, you don't want the world to say, Jews do not serve in the army. Jews are not loyal citizens. Jews are a fifth column. Jews will do anything to get away from their legal responsibilities. If chas v'chalila, if you don't go into the army, you're healthy, you're at draft age, then you can bring endless problems to the Jewish people. And he calls this a Chilul Hashem. And once you have a Chilul Hashem, you can endanger the rest of the Jewish people. It is literally sakanet nefeshat, bikuach nefesh, for the totality of Jewish existence in Germany. Well, if you take this, take Jackie Mason. You've all heard, you know who I'm talking about, Jackie Mason? They don't know. Jackie Mazur. When I learned in Lakewood, there were two or three of his brothers, I think. All three of his brothers got smicha. The name is Mazur, M-A-Z-U-R. Their father was a wonderful Rav, Talmud Chacham, and the brothers, everyone. And one brother also learned in yeshiva, grew up properly. I taught his nieces, his nephews, some of them don't want to mention his name. He describes it this way. It's not entirely true. He was a chazan. I don't think he got smicha, but he describes himself as a rabbi preaching sermons. And a rabbi preaching sermons, he said, my balabatim loved my sermons because they could laugh at my jokes. They laughed so much that the Gentiles came in to hear my jokes on Shabbos. It reached the point that the Jews couldn't get into shul because it was filled with Gentiles. And then he became a world-famous comedian, changing his name from Mazur to Mason. And if you haven't heard Jackie Mason, go to YouTube, put in Jackie Mason. You'll get him on Broadway, you'll get him in Israel. And Israel was unbelievable. It was 1996. I remember the B'nai Huma, big crowd. And they had it on, I watched it on television. My wife, we knew so many people in the crowd. And he had just come from Tel Aviv. And in Tel Aviv, you know, stand-up comedians have to tell an off-color joke. So he started to tell an off-color joke in Yerushalayim. And the crowd is not responding. This is a Yerushalayim Anglo crowd. This is a Katamon crowd. You understand? The Krechavya crowd, the Shari Chesed crowd, a Talbiya crowd. Today it would include Arnona as well, as a Habiyah. It's a different world today. And he sees the audience is not responding. On the spot, he pulls a kippah out of his pocket and he goes into Chazonis, the Kedusha of Musaf, fabulous. That man is so talented. That's Jackie Mason. But Jackie Mason tells jokes. Let me tell you one joke that he told. That you again, your father or mother will have to explain it to you. One joke that he told that I've used. I once had a guy. There was a guy in Borough Park who I knew from the bank there. And he was, his mother was Jewish, his father was Italian. I said, boy, a guy like you is fabulous. Either you get it for me wholesale, or you shoot the person and take it. Do you get that joke or not? It's stereotyping. Jews always wholesale. The tribe, I remember in Philadelphia, when I was Rav in Philadelphia, this Jew, also half Jewish, the tribe. You know, the Jew, you got to get a discount. Who introduced in New York? This is true. What I'm about. Did you ever see something advertised $2.99? You know what I'm talking about? In Israel, they outlawed it, by the way. It has to be $2.90, the $2.90, whatever. They outlawed it. What's the idea? It's psychological. It's not $3. Idiot! It's one penny less than $3. So the Jews are get it for your wholesale. An Italian, the Godfather, the Mafia, you don't give it to me, I blow you away. This is stereotyping. All right, Jackie Mason can get away with it. Okay, you want another example of Jackie Mason stereotyping? Very simple, also classic. You're coming out of a Broadway theater now. The Gentiles, what's the first thing they say? Where can I go to get a drink? The Jew comes out. Where can we go to get a cup of coffee with a good shtickel cake with a good piece of cake? That's stereotyping. What the Melamed Lahoel is saying here is that you don't want the Jews stereotyped, that they're running away from their responsibility to the army. That's all the Gentiles have to hear. That's, you're putting the entire Jewish people in sakana. And that's the concept. Do not avoid the draft. Do not do foul methods to keep out of the army. And let me end off the class. He says at the end, just think, he says, if you don't go into the army, and I answer that what you're doing is correct, it means every Jew who cares about Torah will try to avoid the army. Do you know what this will do to the Jewish people? We will bring the entire German Gentile world into uproar against us. It's the last thing in the world we want to do. We have to be good citizens. Be somach on the Balma, go into the army, fulfill your duties, and do the best you can to avoid Chilul Shabbos. But if need be, onus rachmana patre. This is his first Shabbat. Next week we'll see the next one. Next week is very special. Next week I'm dealing with Napoleon's Sanhedrin as well. You follow? You with me, Dov? You know what I'm talking? And that sets the stage for the Melamed Lahoyel looking backwards and for the Rav looking forwards. So my dear students, first of all, I want to thank everyone for coming. You have no idea. My Sunday class, Steve Bressler should have Rafu Shlema. Rabbi Rubin should have Rafu Shlema. Where is Herbie Maltz? We have his grandson here, but we need the grandfather, Kanayin Hara. And Baruch Hashem, I want to welcome the guests from East Brunswick. Glad to see that everyone is on the map, alive, kicking, and having survived the American shutdown. And you're of British origins. You never had a shutdown in there, right? The Queen, they wouldn't embarrass the Queen, I would imagine. All right, so Mizayin Gesund, we got to live with reality. And what's your simcha here in the family?
The bat mitzvah.
Bat mitzvah, la'richa jamim tovim, should be le'kavad u'le'teferet, and you should go on le'gadlet and Torah, you're at Shemayim, and the proper chatan. You understand? That's... As we'll see next week, that becomes very, very important with the Melamed Lahoyel. So what do we do today? All right, we did many things today. I don't know if you're with me. You know, we touched upon many topics that require a few years of study, each topic. But the Melamed Lahoyel is a very fascinating personality. You see from this tshuva what we're talking about. He was totally enmeshed in the German civilization. He was proud of being a German. He had grown up in Hungary. He was much more narrow-minded. And this was Germany. Hard to believe what comes out of Germany only a few years later. This is Germany 100 years ago, 110, 120 years ago. And totally at home. And la halacha la maisa, malamed la hoel, absolutely, totally different than the Mishnah halachat. We also dealt with Lieutenant Birnbaum today and the Jeep. And I'd love to hear, if anyone is in touch with Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter, if he can tell us exactly how his father got along on Shabbat. Now, there's no question that he had to be back home again, back where he was housed, because there was still Sakonat Nefeshet. We're talking at a period where German soldiers were still around. They had conquered the area, but the war was not over. In other words, there always was a certain sakana here. So Einachinami could very well be to have a non-Jew who could drive the Jeep, Roger, whatever his name was, could be that was the solution. Mark, what do you say? As a lieutenant colonel from the American Army chaplaincy, what do you say?
Well, definitely the assistant was not Jewish. I can't speak to what was going on in World War II. Nowadays, we have a lot more ability to do what we want to do.
But tell me, did you ever have to be driven on Shabbat?
No. I mean, we were able to work out. Things are maybe different now.
Okay. Also, as a chaplain, my dear Talmud Mark told me that what Rav Menashe Klein was worried about, though, that having to do confession with a non-Jew, so Mark said that the concept in the army is that a chaplain never has to do anything against his own religious belief. So Mark once had the occasion where a person asked him to say the Lord's Prayer with him, right? And Mark said, look, I can't do that. I'm Jewish, but I'll inform the Protestant chaplain that you want to say the Lord's Prayer. So there is a certain understanding that a Jew can't exactly say something that deals with Trinity and Christian belief or a Lord's Prayer from the New Testament, etc. So I'm happy to hear that. Now I can understand why Chabad is taking over the American army like they're taking over the rest of the Jewish world. And yeah, they're allowed to have beards. This was all worked out, not simple, but believe it, they fought and they accomplished. Now, tomorrow, Be'ezrat HaNotein LaYov Koach, we pick up with Rabbi Bernard Drachman once again, and I'm going to tell you two little incidents from his autobiography, The Unfailing Light, that will shake you up and bring you into the real world and what a rabbi has to go through. And perhaps, is Rabbi Drachman right or wrong? We'll look at it two different ways tomorrow. From there, we sail in to the greater topic. Before we can deal with the American rabbi, the new invention of the early 20th century, we have to deal with what's happening to the Orthodox synagogue. It's going to be very fascinating, because you can produce American rabbis, but you have to have synagogues who want them. And you'll see there's a confluence here of, before we get to the big three, to rabbis Goldstein, Young, and Lichtenstein, you have to get to the synagogues that will house them. And material, very fascinating. All true, 100 years. We'll comment on the side what they wanted 100 years ago and what they would laugh you out of existence today if you try to pull the same shtick in an Orthodox shul. Even in KJ and even in Jewish Center, some of it has been compromised already. How often do you see a high hat? And would they throw you out of KJ if you walk into Daven on a Sunday morning without a tie? Okay? And believe me, I can document for you when KJ lost a bundle of money when they told some very prominent medical doctor to get out because he wasn't wearing a tie. He was coming from the tennis court on a Sunday morning. All right, some of the freebies. First of all, pass this to Moshe. This, I'll tell you, he's unbelievable. This is dealing with Chumim, with last week's Pasha. Pass this to Chaim. Chaim, am I overburdening you with material, or you get a chance to look, or it's too much for you? You don't want me to, if you want me to stop, tell me. I don't want to overburden you, but if you want to know what's going on here, I've lived here 50 years. I still don't know what's going on with the election. So if I don't know, can imagine if you're here 5 months, what we find is like. This is for you too, Bishela. Everyone knows this is given out free. When you live in Israel, you get a free daily paper that's the equal of any American newspaper, Yisrael Hayom, free of charge, 100 pages, Friday 200 pages. The paper that made, who do you call it, Netanyahu Prime Minister, and this is B'Sheva. My student launched this, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Michael Karish, given out free on Friday. What a society. And you should know, Halacha L'Maisa, no one should ever charge you for a newspaper today. Because the advertisements, print became so much cheap. I told you, my first book had to be set by hand. My ninth book, they're just doing a computer program and then they send it off to Kharkov in the Ukraine and you get back 1,000 copies 1 week later. So, and all you're paying for is the binding. The print is next to nothing. Well, of course, there's a few trees that have to be knocked down to make the paper. This is a new website, children, young people, sense of humor. Without a sense of humor, you can't survive as a Jew. You understand? With a chush humor, you will survive. When Yom Ha'atzmut comes, you'll know, if you've lived here, you will understand why to say Halal and Yom Ha'atzmut. You know why? If we survive our leaders, our judges, our politicians, our radio, our TV, our Jackie Masons here, you can only reach one conclusion. The Ribbono Shel Olam, Baruch Hashem, Halal, with a full heart. A new website, I can't get over this. When I was growing up, I was in high school, I remember they organized a new organization. It was called Tides. What is Tides? Knew that, you know, Tides? Oh my gosh, these kids don't help you wash the clothes? Tides.
Singular, singular.
Cleaning detergent. Tide. Excuse me. Anyway, this is Tides. No, this is not singular. Torah im Derech Eretz Society. And I can't believe it. There's a website, resuscitated, very interesting material, all of Torah im Derech Eretz on the contemporary scene. Here's a very interesting article from Fox News, very sad. New York celebrates the legalization of abortion in two birth. You know what that means in two birth? You have any idea? Did you ever? God, and Catholic bishops question Cuomo's faith. All I can say is that these people are playing with fire because Ribbono Shel Olam said he won't destroy the whole world again. But God have mercy, parts of the world, I don't want to spell it out. And if you know the Midrashim with the flood, these type of sins is what was the Makkah B'Potash that brought the flood about. Then I have three copies, wow, about Rebbetzin Chafetz Chaim. Do you know that the Chafetz Chaim's second wife and his son, from the second wife, I believe, reached America, Rav Aaron Kagan, that's right, and the Chafetz Chaim's daughter from the second wife, who married Rav Mendel Zaks, and the Chafetz Chaim said, so they found her copy of, here, the Machane Yisrael, the very book we referred to, and the stamp in it, Rebbetzin Chafetz Chaim, Mrs. Frieda Kagan, and she identified herself, Rebbetzin Chafetz Chaim. So that means my wife would have to identify herself, Rebbetzin Washington. And look at this.
Rockefeller.
No, that's not as well known. Yeah. Washington is known. And here's the calling card, the business card of the son, Rabbi Abraham Kagan, comma. What do you see there, Mark? PhD. Rabbi Hertz, I challenge you to find out where he got a PhD. To the best of my knowledge, he never married, by the way. He very sad, very sad. Say, there's a lot to talk about when the family reached America, but he was loyal to his parents. Finally, this is a riot. Back in the days when Ex-Lax was trying to corner the Yeshiva Nursery Market, and here, Ex-Lax, what is that when you have an upset stomach? Am I right? I long since forgot. What is it?
Laxative,
right. So here they sponsored NIR. NIR was a publication of the Teachers Institute. That would be the 1930s. The owner of Ex-Lax was Israel Matz, who was a member of the of what today is Yeshiva University's Board of Trustees. And here they have an ad, and it's a riot. It's in biblical language. from Paro, from the plagues. And it says, if you take Ex-Lax, you will feel better by tomorrow. All right. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to entertain. Jack, anything troubling you?
No.
Baruch Hashem. And we have to, you have to know, Jack's apartment, he was not in it, but I trust your daughter, Ben Shkoymel, that's some story. The fire in the house,
the hallway,
is something with the electric box coming in, and Jack's apartment all in soot, dirt. And only 3 days in the hotel. See, the insurance companies are very quick to take money, but when they have to pay out, it's Kriyat Yamsuf.
You know,
They fight to keep the payments down.
Right, I understand.
They try to be reasonable, but...
Try to be reasonable, but keep the payments down. All right, and until we meet in Health and Happiness tomorrow morning at 9:05 a.m., I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart of honoring me with your presence, and never forget that final word that's become such a reality. You don't understand this, but whenever I hear people speaking Russian in the autobus and the streets, my heart jumps. And I'll end off around, let me tell you another story. So I had a granddaughter doing Sheirit Lumi, her second year last year in Tel Aviv. So she was a guide for a museum, the Gutman Museum, and for Sarona. You know what Sarona is? Where they knocked down all the houses and reconstructed the whole site where the Germans had a colony until Israel kicked them out for being pro-Nazis right after World War II. And actually the Mossad was there, the government they used there, have very interesting reconstruction. So we went there to have a tour. She was giving a tour, and we went to be with her that day. And I said, fine, let's eat. And it's a very sad story there. Most of the places are not kosher, but there are a few kosher places. And she showed us a vegan place that's kosher. So we went, we had lunch there, and we're eating outside Tel Aviv, beautiful weather. And at the next bench, two Russians, two Israeli-looking, you wouldn't guess where they're from, and they're learning Mishnah Brura and speaking Russian. So I went over, they thought it was a nutnik, I can tell you, again, who the heck are this idiot comes over to us. So I told them, do you know where you're sitting? They looked at me. I said, the nerve center of the Mossad for Russian Jewry was 1 minute away from here. The house is knocked down. There's a sign up, Rehov Albert Mendler. Now they listen to me with one ear. They're still looking down. What an idiot, don't waste our time. And I said to them, do you know Shvutami? Shvutami! They jumped. I'm one of the founders. And I mentioned the names. They saw I was legitimate. Suddenly I became a hero, but I was overwhelmed to hear them learning Mishnah Brura in Russian. You don't understand that, but when we were kids, we demonstrated, let my people go. Shlach et ami v'yavdu. Follow? Until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. Ruchim to you. Ruchim to you.
Machane Yisrael, by the way, is translated into English now.
Right, right. Rabbi Yoshua has been translated. Well, now there's a better translation, you mean?
I don't know.
There's a primitive translation.
There's fairly recently there's something published.
Ah, so that's something new. Yeah. Just turn them off. Good to see you. When did you come in?
A week.
Here in another week.
Good.